philosophy behind the whole thing really comes back to that be, do, have idea. This is where it gets to where I think that the book really does apply to people who are interested in becoming who they ought to be, really at whatever age you are.
As we think about educating our kids, what I want them to do is have such a broad range of perspectives for them to watch a documentary on a particular subject, and that's the mainstream narrative. Okay, let's come to your own conclusion. Do a little bit more researching.
Look at young people today and they'll think that they're really aimless and they're not, you know, they're lost. That people look at them and say they're lost. And they are.
The best thing I can do is say, how can I just equip my kids to be prepared for anything? They have an understanding, they can connect with people of any background because they know enough about how the world works.
And so getting out there and doing stuff is the key to critical thinking. It's not thinking is not the key to critical thinking. It's doing that's the key to critical thinking.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Matt Smith. Matt is a serial entrepreneur and author of a book called The Preparation that he wrote with Doug Casey. He's an Austrian economist. He is also a hardcore Bitcoiner. He is a sound money advocate. The book is very interesting. It's written for young people. It's sort of a college alternative, specifically for young men, but it would apply to young women as well. But stick around, stay tuned. I am taking this to heart and is something I'm going to use to improve myself and better my life as well. You will love this conversation. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I have Matt here with me. Matt, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm super happy to be here with you.
Yeah, I told you offline, I'm very excited for this conversation. I think you have written one of the most important books. Honestly, I think of the 21st century for anyone certainly raising kids. But even as people begin to step back and evaluate, what do I want to do with my time? How do I want to improve my life, my skill set? This is like ultimate low time preference reading in my view. So before we start and jump into all of that, why don't you give a bit of a background, tell people who you are, maybe give a little bit of an intro for Doug Casey, how you met him.
Sure.
And who he is, because I heard him first on Ron Paul's podcast, and I think that'll set the stage for everything else we're discussing.
Sure. Because we're going to talk about education a little bit. I mean, I'm a college dropout. I dropped out and what basically was a serial entrepreneur. I mean, you might not be as obvious right now because I'm basically a cattle rancher because, you know, life goes in weird directions here in Uruguay. But yeah, I've started a whole bunch of different businesses, virtually anything you can imagine, actually, probably more than, I guess if you count the cattle ranch, like 19 businesses. Some successful, some not successful. I'd say the last sort of significant thing I did was a business called Royalty Exchange. It's a marketplace for music royalties. So basically artists, songwriters, you know, they have these, every time their music gets played on Spotify, you know, they earn a little bit of money. And we make it so that if they're interested in selling all or a portion of their royalties, they can sell it directly in a public auction to investors. So they get, you know, they get real market value versus getting screwed over by music industry people. So I've done a whole bunch of different things like that. But you know, the most important thing to me over my adult life has been to not screw up my kids of all things. It really has. I've had almost a do no harm first approach to kids. You know, when they're first born, I think, oh yeah, I'm going to turn you into a much better version of me. And, you know, I have all these ambitions. But ultimately I realized, and I think they are better versions of me, but I think ultimately what I realized was that I should just not cause problems with them because, you know, and that most parents do screw up their kids. All parents have an effect on their children. Some of it might be positive, but certainly some of it's going to be negative. And so the reason I tell you this, is because for the last year or so, really the last 2 years, I've been trying to continue that with my son as he's been sort of launched into adulthood. And entering the world in a very uncertain time, I think, perilous time, one might think, for young people. I think it's much harder for him and my daughter, too, who's 18 now, to enter the world than it was for me. I'm 50. So I think I had it a lot easier than they do, frankly. So trying to make sure that happened as best as possible, my son and I did this experiment, and this goes to the Doug Casey part. That was based upon an idea that Doug had, that he approached me about writing a book with him maybe a dozen years ago that he was calling Renaissance Man. And you know, he wanted me to write it with him. He also told me, he's written many books, and when he wanted me to write it with him, he told me how terrible writing books were. He said, it's a lot of brain damage. You don't make any money, but I'd like you to write this book with me. I wasn't interested. But when my son got to the point where I felt like he really needed something like that, where that kind of became clear to me, I reached out to Doug and I said, let's talk about this in more detail and see what we can do with it. And the biggest thing he told me about it was, if you don't know who Doug is, by the way, how do I explain Doug? Doug is a Renaissance man. Doug has basically been everywhere, done everything. Some people call him the international man. He really is like a living embodiment of those that guy in those Stasekis commercials. I don't know if you remember those from years back, the most interesting man in the world. I mean, he's really done wild stuff everywhere. You know, he's 79 now, but he's a total badass. Anyway, I met him coincidentally. You know, I was a fan of his work, but I actually met him on the streets in Buenos Aires in 2007, just totally accidentally. But then over the years we built a relationship. But yeah, he's an economist, an author, speculator. I mean, you're a philosopher, really, is what he really is. And so when I asked him what this book was about, what he really wanted to do, and he said, well, Matt, give me a very vague answer. He said, you know, I want the book to be about the three most important verbs in every language: be, do, and have. Honestly, I didn't know what he was talking about when he said that. So, but in the book, we do get into it and explain what it really is all about.
Yeah. So let's warm you up to the audience a little bit. I think that's a great background. But one of the things that people, I think anyone listening to this will appreciate, is my impression at least, is you and Doug are sound money advocates. You tend to lean toward the Austrian school of economics. A lot of no nonsense. You're not a bunch of communists, Keynesians, anything like that. Maybe could you share sort of sort of broadly your worldview, philosophy when it comes to that, and then we'll jump into the book.
Yeah, I think Austrian economics probably pretty much sums it up better than anything. I don't really like the label libertarian for some reason. I think maybe mostly because that term is discredited. Unfortunately, but basically those are my ideas. I believe in the individual. I love people. I believe in individuals. I think that the power of the individual is all that matters, and the rights of the individual are all that matters. I think that our system is completely screwed because of the money system. It's all fraud. You know, at the end of the day, the entire system, I have to understand, when you take the monetary unit and you commit fraud with it, it causes crazy amounts of fraud all throughout the system in ways that we don't even recognize as fraud now, because we're so accustomed to it. We're swimming in it. So yeah, I have a big problem with the money system. I certainly am a big believer in gold in particular. I first bought my first Bitcoin probably in early 2012, lost that Bitcoin, by the way. But I bought more in, I guess 2015, which I also lost. But I didn't take it seriously where I bought any real serious amount until late 2016, when it was, you know, around the $700 mark. But then I understood it finally. And so I bought a lot more of it, way more of it then in 2016 and early 2017 than I ever did before that. Before that, I was just trying to understand it and, you know, buy like $20. Of course, that $20 now would be worth quite a bit, but, you know, it wasn't a serious investment for me. Like, it started to be in 2016.
Yeah. I'm sure that message is going to resonate well with anyone listening. So let's jump into the book. So this book is, and I just want to say, for anyone who's listening and you hear this book is like a curriculum, it's for young men, you know, a college alternative, I think all of that's true. That's how you would frame it. For me, this has been much more influential than that. I'm not only thinking about my 5-year-old son, even my two daughters, but even for myself, like, you know, I have time, and I want to be the interesting type of person and learn all the things that I wish I had learned in the first, you know, 22 years of my life that I simply didn't. I went through a very traditional education experience, you know, public school for most of my time, private school for most of high school, went on to college, did the whole thing, right? And so it wasn't until several years later, really till I went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, that I realized how little I had actually learned and accomplished and how few skills I had actually emerged with as a result of many, many, many hundreds, thousands of hours of sitting in a classroom. So you wrote this book about, in particular, molding, I think, a young man, giving them an alternative, an opt-out of college. Can you explain what inspired, so the Be Do Have, what inspired sort of the approach, the narrowness that you took to this book, specifically as a curriculum for people?
Yeah, well, you have to understand the number one problem I had in my mind. Now, Doug wanted us to write a book. What I wanted to do was solve a very specific problem for my son. So in a way, this book literally is the book that for a father to a son, my best effort to give him whatever information I thought he needed now, not all the information he'll need, but the information he needed at this stage in life. So that's the narrowness. So it comes down to exactly what he should do. And my son has been a great sport about it because he's been our guinea pig for the last 2 years. And, he didn't have the book to start off with this highly structured approach. You have to understand, we started off with something way looser where we're kind of grasping at straws to put it together. So he's been a great sport about it. And he's really risen to the occasion in ways I didn't expect, honestly. It's been fantastic. But the philosophy behind the whole thing really comes back to that Be Do Have idea. And this is where it gets to where I think that the book really does apply to people who are interested in becoming who they ought to be, really at whatever age you are. Everyone in our society today, and as partly as this fiat money system is part of it, is everyone is only concerned with have. I mean, that's what we think about. It's our reference point. I'd like to have these things. I'd like to, whether it be the new iPhone or, a beautiful spouse. It's all about acquisition of stuff. And not that there's anything wrong with it. I like stuff. I have a lot of stuff. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. But what it's not mentioned to people is that, that have is a consequence of do. I mean, it is, you don't get have by seeking have. You get have by doing. And the thing that's so important about that, especially for young people, and I really think for anybody, but for a young man, for them to understand that if they are willing to do things, to do a lot, to do, like to really put themselves out there and do things, then the have is all possible. The have can be done, but you have to do it by focusing on doing. So what we do is show young people, we show anyone really, that it's a huge leverage point. I mean, my son, who's 20, has unlimited amounts of energy. I do not, it just changes over time. And so when you have that, it's your greatest asset. I mean, you have this greatest strength essentially is that you have so much energy. You can actually channel in a way that can give you all the have you can imagine and probably a lot more, quite frankly. So the have are the be, do, and have. So the last one is be. And really, truly, this is the only one that actually matters. This is the one you're going to think about. This is, if you're dissatisfied with your life, and I know a lot of people who have a lot of stuff who are very dissatisfied with their life, it's because they never resolved this be aspect. They are not the man they want to become. And, a lot of people, look at young people today and they'll think that they're really aimless and they're not, they're lost. That people look at them and say they're lost. And they are. And why is it? Because the reason that they're lost is because they're focused on the wrong things. They're not focused on trying to become the man they want to become. Instead, they're focusing on having things. And so the book is fundamentally about the question, what we try and reorient for a person is to get them to focus on the be first of all. Like, this should be your guiding star. This should be and for my son, I have to say, and for young men who are also following the program who I've spoken with, it's super motivating to them. That is very motivating for them to try and, for my son, it's like it's Edmond Dantes in The Count of Monte Cristo was at first his original motivation. He just loved the character. But that's really motivating for him, especially when he's going through things that are pretty difficult because a lot of stuff in the book can be pretty challenging.
Right. I think that's an interesting way of framing it. And as I think about sort of a microcosm in my life, the days that I go to bed feeling most fulfilled and like a day I can hang my hat on are never the days I got a new car, I acquired a new thing, but the days that I got up early, I read, I got my workout in, I spent time with my family, I got a lot of work done. Like it's all of the being and doing and the self-improvement and like the self-actualization. Maybe that feels
exactly
a little cliche, but
exactly
all of those things really has a lot less to do with that.
Yeah. And the doing naturally, it's like it's a virtuous cycle, right? The doing makes you be, the being helps you do, and it creates this virtual cycle, and all of a sudden have starts to show up.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about it having a personal code in the book. I can't remember if it was you or Doug who wrote that chapter. So talk a little bit about that, because it actually, I was thinking I was about to open it, get sort of an introduction, and it was going to go into this curriculum. And the curriculum is really only maybe the back half, back third of the book. It is detailed. There's a lot in there. I'm literally, best I can with the limited time I have, I'm going to start just kind of working my way through the courses. I'll eventually get to like the anchor courses that we'll talk about. But talk a little bit about what you put into the front of the book, the personal code, some of the other things, and why you spent the time you spent setting it up before you got to sort of the tactical elements of everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, thinking about it with a young person, you know, they grow up, and I would say probably anyone who's listening to this, if you're under 40, this is probably true for you too, is that, you know, you've grown up in the most scheduled, surveilled, tracked, planned, institutionalized way of any population in human history. I mean, and when the problem with that is that you don't really even know what you want. You don't really even know what's important to you, mostly because you've had to follow the rules of everyone else around you. I mean, just growing up, right? And now your son, your kids, they live under house rules, right? I mean, you create the reality for them. They haven't decided yet what's important to them. And the trouble is that most people never decide what's important to them. They never decide what their own rules are. And so with the personal code, what we try and do, and I'll explain the problem with that in a second, but with the personal code, what we do is we ask the person to, three stages to it. The first one is just develop a set of rules for themselves. And this is the reason this is important, I'll just explain it now, I guess, is that up until then, all the rules are created for them, whether they make sense or not, or they're going with the crowd. And by deciding for themselves some rules, they're actually establishing their self-esteem, their actual self-esteem for the first time. You know, a place where they're deciding, no, this is who I am. These are the things that I do. These are the things that I will not do. And deciding them for themselves. And we ask, how do you come up with these rules? Well, you shouldn't rely on anyone else around you. You should just think to yourself, when you do something that makes you feel small or causes you shame, decide you're not going to do those things anymore. Now, the whole world might not know you do them, but you do. And when you do them, they make you feel small. Like for me, it's like lying makes me feel terrible, makes me feel like pathetic. It really does. It makes me feel very small, even a white lie. But it's so easy. And, you know, just a normal convention, do a white lie. Like you invited me out for dinner on Friday and I didn't want to go. I can't this Friday. I'm busy. You know, that's a natural. It's so natural, that little white lie. But every time I do that, it makes me feel like crap. It's so much easier just to say, hey, man, I'm not really up to it it doesn't sound very good for me this Friday, but maybe sometime in the future. You know, just being honest about it makes it easy for me. So for me, that's a rule. That's a rule. I just don't lie. I will not lie, even a white lie. I'll say I don't really want to talk about it. I might not answer the question, but, you know, I'm just not going to lie. And so for when a person starts to decide those, I will not cross this line. This is what's important to me. And they start following it. They build a little beachhead of little personal identity, a place where they can stand on where they, for the first time, are differentiated as an individual separate from their parents' doctrine or the school's expectations or, you know, what your friends are all doing. And it's yours. You own it. And so I think that's the basis of it. It starts there. Then what we do is we expose people to the ancient virtues, you know, things like courage. And these are things that are not, you know, sort of a pass-fail rule. These are things that you aspire to. These are things that you can never have. You can never be courageous, you know, enough. I mean, you could always be more courageous. So, you know, these things are aspirations. So we ask the person to go through it and pick, you know, half a dozen that really speak to them. And it's different for everybody. I mean, they aren't universal for everybody where they really call to you. And we ask them to then write those down and try to emulate those, try to strive toward those things as much as you can. And then finally, we ask them to start documenting skills, like just writing it down, the things that you can do. And in the preparation, they stack up super fast. The skills stack up really fast, actually. And so over time, you start to like, you could see yourself, you know, where you're going, the direction, what matters to you. And it I think it's a great basis to sort of engage the world with deciding in advance the man you want to become. And the personal code is the start to it.
I think it's such an important thing. What I've learned about myself is that I'm actually very good at setting rules for myself. Most people just want to be completely, any like libertarian, classical liberal type of person wants self-sovereignty to do what they want. But I think with that responsibility, or with that becomes a lot of responsibility. And for me, and this is sort of an aside because it's not character-based, but I have, you know, certain foods I won't eat. Because I've just made that rule. And I think to have a young person, you know, a kid basically, who is growing up defining what those rules are for themselves as they make a determination, to your point, about what just, you know, doesn't feel right to them. And to begin ingraining that into reminding themselves of it daily, to where when they reach, you know, an age where they have to go off into the world, it's not because you've harped on the same things over and over, which I think is important as parents, is to, you know, instill discipline and instill a sense of character and virtues, but for them to have made that determination themselves. And then as we get into now the curriculum, it the way that they go about engaging in, you know, some very interesting, some might say risky courses and ventures, that they have instilled in themselves a sense of character, a sense of courage, a sense of patience, all of the things required to go do everything else that, you know, you write about in the book well and competently. And I think it was a great way to sort of tee these people, tee anyone up who's going to be reading this and taking it seriously. So before we jump into the curriculum specifically, could you maybe talk a little bit about why is everyone funneled like cattle into college? And why is it that it doesn't work? It demonstrably does not work for most people who go to college. Even if they are smart, get good grades, pass all the tests, they're coming out, in my view, completely unequipped for real life. They might get a job, and many don't. But even if they do get a job, it's unfulfilling. They don't have any other skills outside of just complete, you know, being a task doer for a big company. What led us down this path that forced you into a position where you felt like you needed to write this sort of content for your kids?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just, well, what really has made it so big and so dominant is just the economic setup of it. I'm big into economics. So, I mean, the economic drivers behind it, there's so much money to be made in encouraging kids to do it and then milking them for the rest of their lives with these student loans afterwards. So there's just a giant machine that has every incentive in the world to associate status with going to college and, you know, talk about as a, you know, the college experience. What the hell's that? I'm not really sure. I mean, I was there for 2 years. I didn't notice anything that was, they say was really great. I didn't finish. So maybe I missed it. But you know, the thing is that I think there is, you know, as our economy shifted to a services-based economy, you know, then white collar essentially replaced blue collar jobs as in a services economy, and that ends up being training people for generalist type of paper shuffling or, you know, computer spreadsheet jockeying type work, and that's our economy has just been funneled and optimized in that direction really for the last 30 years. The problem is we're seeing the ends of that now. And it did, you know, it did work for a lot of people. It really did work in terms of it made them able to earn an income. But, you know, what we challenge in the book, I think, is this idea is that a worthwhile pursuit? Is the ability to pay your rent? And now that's important. But is that what you should devote your life to, a pursuit that actually makes you now able, hopefully, to be so you can economically support yourself? Now, of course, those things are important. Being able to economically support yourself is important. But like, what are the precursors of that generally? I mean, there's a lot of independence beyond that that occurs. There's a lot of skill development that occurs. And that's what we try and achieve with the preparation. Again, Doug's idea of Renaissance Man. It's a, you know, we didn't name it Renaissance Man, frankly, because if you ask my son what that is, he has no idea or had no idea. It didn't have any association with it. But essentially, in a modern terms, the way I would see it is a real Renaissance Man today would be somebody who understands how the world works across a breadth of understanding, you know, in the real world, how things actually work. They understand it and they know how to successfully engage with the world to create stuff. So whether that be knowing how to build a house or understanding physics, you know, or, you know, learning to sail. I mean, whatever. I mean, like, but really understanding about a wide range of things, being able to speak a foreign language, I mean, like all these things, playing guitar. I mean, the wide range of understanding. So that whereas now, when most people come out of college or when people are now trained for a job, they have very little understanding of reality at all. I mean, they're not equipped to deal with reality in any way because they don't even have any understanding of it. Yeah, you know how to order things on an app, or you know how to, you know, maybe you know how to show up to an office, maybe, but they don't. And I mean, you go to college, it's 12 credit hours is considered full time, right? So that doesn't really prepare you for a 40-hour job if that's what you wanted anyway. So and a lot of people have like this crazy realization too late when they finish college. They've taken on student debt the entire time. Everyone has looked at them and told them they're doing the right thing, like they're succeeding. And then they end up 3 months into their job, wondering, you know, not like understand with the job not being what they expected, with the hours being worse than they expected, with the, you know, life balance nowhere near what they ever imagined it would be like, not earning enough money to cover their student loans and pay their rent, and then realizing that they're stuck now. They're stuck. They're trapped in this place because now they have this obligation that they have to pay every month. They gotta go to the work just to be able to get the money to be able to pay the student loan and the rent and hopefully, you know, have enough to eat. So, you know, that's this pressure, this pushing everybody down this funnel is now kind of it's hitting its ultimate decline at this stage. And with AI, it's just making the situation fantastically worse and way more uncertain for people who are, you know, trying to get launched in the world.
Yeah. If I were to maybe something you're hitting on here, the breadth of skills and the breadth of knowledge, courses, books that you guys describe here, one of the things I take away from it that I would have never thought about growing up, going to school, is you hear about critical thinking. And people say critical thinking is the most important skill. And honest, I'm 36 years old. It wasn't until I went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and started to realize all the things I'd been lied to about that I really began to appreciate what it means to think critically. And so I'll give you a quick example. You grew up in school learning about, in the US, learning about the Civil War and, you know, Lincoln freed the slaves. And here's what happened in the Civil War. I'm reading a book called The Problem with Lincoln right now. And it's a book that was recommended to me by the same guy who recommended I listen to Doug's podcast with Ron Paul. And the long story short is this book describes Lincoln as a tyrant. No slaves were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. The First Amendment habeas corpus were suspended under his administration. Every other country who had slavery ended it, except Haiti, ended it peacefully. No civil war required. And basically, you were lied to about the Civil War. I told my wife, I'm reading this book, and I'm like asking ChatGPT, which has a very mainstream narrative about the world. Everything's very mainstream. And ChatGPT is confirming many of the things that this guy's saying in his book. And I told her, I said, look, I wasn't there. I can't know for sure what the answer was, what exactly happened during the Civil War. I have my hunch based on, you know, new findings. And the fact that we were told this means that we were probably lied to because we were lied to about everything else. But as we think about educating our kids, what I want them to do is have such a broad range of perspectives for them to watch, you know, a documentary on a particular subject. And that's the mainstream narrative. Okay, let's find the tinfoil hat or the alternative perspective and come to your own conclusion. Do a little bit more research. And like, that's the critical thinking. The problem is most people don't have like these nodes of information to pull from across a diverse range of perspectives. And what I love about your book and your approach to this is they get that. The amount of reading, the amount of online coursework, the cycles that they go through with these anchor courses, it's almost impossible for you to just follow the preparation all the way through and not be really good at thinking through how do I solve a particular problem? Which of these potential, you know, narratives makes the most sense? I just can't see that happening for anyone. So explain the structure of the cycles, the curriculum in general, and then we can dig into a bit more of the detail.
Yeah, I mean, we're modeling the assuming the typical reader would be like my son, who's basically choosing maybe to go to college or something else. You know, and today the only option someone has that's actually laid out for you clearly, you could go to trade school. You know, you could become a plumber or something like that. And there's nothing wrong, honorable for professions as far as I'm concerned, and a lot more lucrative than a lot of the white collar jobs today. So you could do that. You could join the military. That's what I did. Well, National Guard, but to pay for my college, you know, or go to college. And those are it. There's nothing else that's clear, laid out. If you do any of those three things, most people will say, okay, you're succeeding. If you try anything other than that, anything that's not that, you'll look like a failure to everybody. And and it's really unclear. It's an uncharted territory as far as what exactly to do. So what we attempted to do is lay out exactly what you ought to do, like a different option, something that is equivalent in terms of the basic time frame, you know, that it requires of you, and essentially the basic structure of college. So that for that reason, we broke it into 4 years, and each year has four quarters. We call each quarter a cycle, and each cycle has a theme. And at the base of each cycle is what we call an anchor course. So, you know, like for one cycle, my son did sailing, and which, you know, it doesn't sound that intense. I don't really like boats myself, but it was pretty intense. The actual what you do, at least what he did, and certainly what's recommended in the book, is he was sailing around the Falkland Islands and across the Atlantic and through the Strait of Magellan into Chile. And it was actually his first experience on a boat, to be honest. And it was rough. I mean, it was hard ass work, and it was a gigantic rite of passage for him, is what it ended up being. He learned a lot. He's a competent crewman now, so he can work on a sailboat if he wants to. And essentially this is the way how a lot of them are structured, is that this anchor activity is something where you learn a very discrete skill, something very specific that also in most cases has a real economic value as well. Meaning you could, if you wanted to, do something with it and earn income from it. Not to say we're even recommending it, but, you know, true useful skills should have some economic value. Like someone would pay for someone who can do those things. So the first one my son did, and the first one I actually recommend everyone do if you're going to do it, is the EMT medic cycle. And the medic cycle has an anchor course of getting your EMT certification. And that's legitimately valuable. You can work on an ambulance or something like that, of course, but you literally learn how to save a life. I mean, it's not just the CPR training. It's really intense. Certainly the knowledge that my son has after going through this far exceeds any medical knowledge. And I'll tell you, you feel better having him around. Like he knows what to do if there's a problem. So in addition to the anchor course, there's online courses that you take, you know, academics. And, you know, today you can get, I mean, MIT course catalog is all available for free. Yale's catalog is mostly available for free. A lot of Stanford's. I mean, most of what, really anything you might want to know is available for free or nearly free online. And so we outline specifically what courses you should take. And, you know, there's room for electives too, but we have some what we consider required courses in there. And free or next to free, all online, and they're good. They're very good. And in addition to that, there's a lot of reading. There's also, we encourage people to do lots of activities. So, you know, like I'll just talk about my son's experience. So, yeah, he learned to play guitar. He's, you know, learned to speak Spanish, plays Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I mean, a whole bunch of different activities. We list a whole bunch to do, but the idea is that you fill in some of your week with some of these other activities too, just to get a sample, just to even see what's it like to just try these things out. Skydiving, scuba diving. I mean, he's done quite a bit. And so you do that. And the last part of each cycle is an accountability piece to it. Essentially, every week, you're just basically documenting what you got done that week. You know, so you could basically show your work, because this, you know, essentially you're driving the process yourself. If hopefully you're lucky and you have parental support, meaning encouragement, and you have somebody to share this with, like, here's what I got done this week. But it makes a gigantic difference, and it builds in this, I think it's super good for character, and it builds this basic, it builds in the basic mechanisms for success in life when you can hold yourself accountable to delivering results each and every week. I mean, that's the key to success, where you just do it on your own. And that's kind of built in there. So all this in total, it equates to about 40 productive hours a week. Now, I've had a lot of employees in my life, and I can tell you that the average employee works for about 40 hours, but they're not even 40 hours productive in a week. You know, it's probably more like 28, 32, I think people estimate in. So it's intense. Unlike college, where it would be 12 credit hours, you know, it's 12 hours in the classroom a week. I mean, this is 40 a week, but, you know, you count things like your gym time, or, you know, if you have a part-time job in there, that can count your working, because we encourage people to work through the program as well. And you do learn a lot of stuff, even working totally, you know, bullshit jobs. I mean, delivering pizzas or working at Office Depot. I mean, those things, and they can fund doing really cool shit at the same time.
Yeah. I think that's awesome. I think back to my college years, my high school years, and my brother and I are a few years apart, but we were sort of inseparable to the extent we could be. And I told him, I said, can you imagine, knowing what we know now and sort of the men we want to be, if we had just not played video games, not cared about, you know, all the other bullshit that you basically experience as part of college, especially as a guy. I mean, I'm sure women are wasting their time in their own ways, but I can think very tangibly about things I would do differently. And I've been dedicating all of that time that we were just, you know, messing around to learning, to taking courses like this. I started working toward my becoming a private pilot, and flew solo. And I was in school and didn't have when I went back to school, I didn't have a place to go continue it. So it didn't work very well. However, what I'll say is, in addition to gaining competency through these anchor courses, what I love about them is most of them are intense in some form or fashion. And if nothing else, I've been in a cockpit by myself, you know, several thousand feet above ground, and it instills this understanding that you can do things. I don't think most people think they can do things. And once you have an expert show you, and then let go of the reins, and now it's on you, you realize very quickly that people are way more competent than they're more capable than they could ever possibly realize. It's like a very freeing feeling, knowing that you're able to figure things out when you've never probably given yourself that liberty.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree. A couple of comments about that. I think that the reason that young men in particular waste time, is how it feels looking back on it, playing video games or whatever, it's because there's nothing else to do. I mean, no, it's not obvious what else to do. I mean, because listen, you know, there are some people might frown on the things like, you know, just watching Netflix all the time or whatever, playing video games. But the truth is, that's one of the society's approved activities. Nobody complains. You know, I mean, go do it. I mean, your parents might complain. And when I hear parents complain about that to young people, I say, well, give the kids some better options. Because if they had a better option, they would do it. Something that's exciting, that challenges them, that motivates them. People want to do, most people, I can say for young men for sure, they want to be somebody. They want to be somebody. And they realize that to be somebody, you got to do something worthy. But nobody is even presenting them with anything that's worth doing. So what do? They squander their time. Yeah, because they don't know. They don't know. And so the whole point of this is we stack these cycles so that you get exposed to a whole bunch of stuff, which the part of the beauty of the program, why it works as well as it does, is because one of the cycles, like you mentioned, was getting your pilot's license, for instance. And I mean, that's an intense experience. I've never got my license actually, but I only flew like 15 hours. I never even did the solo. This was a long time ago before I had kids. And it was, you know, I mean, it's an intense experience in and of itself. Now, take that. And then you go, after the 3 months, you're done, which means you really find a place you can really cram it in. And you're on to something totally new, totally, completely new. And whether it's the EMT cycle or it's the sailing cycle or, you know, these things start off in the very foundational or very physical, and they get into the abstract over time. So there's 16 in total. The last four start to get pretty abstract. You know, there's investor, entrepreneur, maker, for instance. So these things are, they get a lot, they're a lot we don't recommend people start with these things, but they work better once you build the skill set. And the way they stack on top of each other is pretty amazing when you see it in real life. And you're learning along the way. Not that you can make any money really getting your private pilots, but it does teach you a level of seriousness, situational awareness, technical detail, you know, that you're just not, you're going to get in very other, it's rare you'll get that in any other form of training that's really out there. And by the way, you can get your pilot's license when you're 15 years old. Like you don't, it's just kind of outrageous really, but.
But it's like weather, the native phonetic alphabet, communication, like all of these things that like are just little skills. It's sort of like sailing. I'm sure your son learned how to tie knots.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, okay, it's like that little stuff that you can then use in other applications in life. And, you know, I remember, I mean, this is more personal, but I remember when I was 18, all you wanted to do is impress a girl. And I think about if my son could grow up knowing these things, and I just, you know, it's just sort of natural. Like he's going to be an impressive person worthy of someone who is equally impressive. And it's just a matter of like stacking skills, having experiences, and staying humble throughout, you know, knowing well,
the great thing about these experiences is that they humble you every time. So every 3 months you get humbled. Now you build yourself up, but because you start off as an idiot, you know, nothing, yeah. You know, you're showing up and you have to go through that, you know, newbie process over and over again. And it really, it forces you to realize how little you know, even as you start to learn so much more about reality.
Especially like the fighting, you know, isn't Muay Thai in Thailand one of the anchor courses?
It is. That's so Max's last cycle was the entrepreneurship cycle. He finished that at the end of the year, and he's right now in Japan on his way to Thailand, and he is going to spend 2 months in Chiang Mai at a Muay Thai camp.
Okay. Does he have fighting experience, or is this like,
he's got BJJ experience. He's got a little bit of, like kickboxing, striking experience, but no, he's never had anything this intense. I mean, this is like, you know, you have two training sessions a day and you know, it's intense. It's a camp. Awesome. Yeah.
So cool. So explain how so you've got the anchor course that's for everyone who's, you know, trying to keep everyone up. So that's the fighting, the EMT, the flying, sailing. And then you have all of these other courses that you recommend, books. Talk to me a little bit about the courses, because I know it's not all a perfect one-to-one, but to the extent that you've been able, those courses generally coincide to some degree with that theme of the cycle.
Yeah, this is one of the problems with normal school is that you wonder why you don't. I mean, I always felt like, one, what's the point of the stuff they're teaching me? Like, I didn't understand what the use of it would be. And, you know, and second of all, it's all so disconnected from each other that you don't get the advantages of making any connections. Because as you're learning, you know, when you're really learning something, you start to put together like this sort of web of understanding, you know, and it makes it easier to remember. It makes it things you discover knowledge basically in the information as it ties together. So as much as possible, we try and keep the academics and the reading as much associated with the theme of the cycle as anything could be. Like we have a cowboy cycle where, you know, for this one for my son, I apprenticed him to our gaucho actually, which is like an Uruguayan cowboy. But you know, there's a couple schools we recommend that people go to in the US. And so like the reading that goes wrong with it, it's like the history of the American West, you know, you're learning about that. Like some of the leisure reading is these, I don't know if you've ever read any Louis L'Amour, but he's like this pulp Western fiction books. And they're great, actually. They're great for in terms of character, because the hero in it is always, it's just a normal guy in the Western, right? Who's just got character, makes the right decision, does the hard thing, all that. So you get to see examples, because we don't have many, I think this is intentional. There's very few good male or female, for that matter, role models for young people. Like who should they aspire to be? Is it the only examples out there are people who have stuff, have money, you know, maybe an Andrew Tate, who's, you know, not of great character, but he's got money and girls. So, you know, and he says stuff that's true. So like, that's what they've got.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. I think about that. My wife actually told me, she said, you have no idea how proud I am and how proud you should be that our 7-year-old daughter does not know who Taylor Swift is. Oh. I said, thank you, because I don't want to listen to that music as we drive around anyway, much less do I want my daughter thinking that that's someone that they need to look up to. The books. So my sense, I sort of flip through the books because there's a lot of content for everyone listening. If you're going to go look at this, there really is a lot. The books also tend to align with the cycles, but part of it is there, I've got the book here. Is it recommended reading at the end where it's a lot of the classics? They're Austrian economic books. What was sort of the design of that? And is that just supplemental to it all? Or
so the books,
some of it goes into the curriculum specifically, but some of it's external.
Well, what we have is we have, just like with the courses, we've got like a kind of a course catalog for these online courses. And we've, in some cases, we've put them into the cycle and say, this is like required, but there's hours left over to get your total of, you know, what you're trying to get for the cycle. There's hours where you can fill in other ones, whatever's of interest to you. And it's the same is true for books. So there's some books where you go, no, you really should read this one. And, you know, we wouldn't give you a history book that told you the fake narrative of the Civil War, by the way. You would know it wasn't about freeing the slaves. But there's some specific ones we might recommend, but for the most part, you know, so you want to get that foundation. You should be exposed to these things, but you would become a good reader in doing this because there is a lot of reading. I think Max read 56 books last year.
Wow.
You know, which sounds like a lot, but you just a little bit every day, you'd be surprised. You know, you go through it pretty quickly. And, you know, what you want a lot of reading, you want it to be people following their curiosity. So, you know, we have some required. And then there's electives, and we give you some options. If you don't know what might be worth reading, here are some things that we can recommend.
Okay. So who was the proponent of putting classical music in? This was an interesting one for me.
Doug.
Okay, Doug. He's a big classical music guy.
Oh, he painstakingly put together that list, actually. I mean, every concerto on there is 100% Doug.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. To me, though, it's interesting, though, because... So, I've never studied classical music at all. I've never listened to it. I imagine it's something if you can dig in and begin to appreciate exactly. Like I'll tell you the one time I've appreciated classical music was my wife and I did a trip to Europe. We went to Salzburg, Austria, and we ended up at the Salzburg Fortress watching a Mozart, you know, themed.
Can't get better than that. Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And you realize the technical ability required to play that today, much less to compose that, you know, hundreds of years ago. And people are still listening to it and appreciating it for what it is, you know, so many years later. But I think it's one of those things. It just like, it adds a new dimension of interest about you as a person.
It's just like, there should be things that are just off limits to you. Art is a hard thing because the truth is that all art requires appreciation to appreciate it. It really does. I mean, it requires the more you know, and this is true about it, I think everything in life, the more you know about it, the more interesting it becomes. You know, the more you know, like you can go down crazy rabbit holes of weird, you know, interest and it's just in random stuff that people that feels very like very much like a niche. But as you get to know more, you find you get really, really into it. And so what Doug thinks it's, I grew up actually listening to classical music all the time, but I was the weird guy who only listened to classical music in high school. Yeah. I don't know why, but I did. And I think, and I like now I'll just have his background music, you know, but I think that his idea is that this is a form of high art, high culture, and that you should be exposed to it at least. Not to say you could be like, hey, you know, not my thing. That's totally fine. It doesn't really matter. But you should be exposed to it. And there's art appreciation courses in here to teach you about visual arts as well. I mean, because again, this is something a Renaissance man would know something about these things. Not to say they'd be an expert, but they'd know something about it. And you know, so, but yeah, that list is his. He was.
I think you're hitting on it. Is it's And especially in a world where we're moving into a world of AI, whether people like it or not. And it is like, as I think about that, it is completely unclear to me precisely what skill sets I need to, you know, 15 years ago, I would have said, my kids need to learn how to code. You know, they need to have pretty strong technical skills. And now that's not going to be very helpful. I mean, you're going to have 1% of the best in the world are going to continue to operate in some capacity doing that or controlling the machines maybe. But that those things are going away. And so in light of that uncertainty, the best thing I can do is say, how can I just equip my kids to be prepared for anything? They have an understanding. They can connect with people of any background because they know enough about how the world works, art, music, they can do things. And I think that's going to set them up for the financial success that you describe as not necessarily being the preeminent driver behind all of this, but obviously a practically, you know, very important function of you know, becoming yeah, I mean, a
you gotta adult. You gotta pay the rent some one way or another. But I'll tell you, the way these things roll into it, the way you have is by doing things that are valuable to others is how you start to, you know, it really can take off for you financially. And the best position to be in for that is being an entrepreneur. And of course, you know, if I had I would encourage everyone to be an entrepreneur, but everybody. But I think that most people are not equipped to do it because they just don't, they don't have enough understanding of how anything works, you mm-hmm. know, to do it. And really being an entrepreneur is being able to make connections and things and understand how you can create value in a space. But the way these things compound in the preparation. So, you know, my son got the EMT thing and then he got offered a job. This is another thing, people were very surprised. Once you start doing stuff and you put yourself out there kind of publicly, where he was just, you know, writing down what he did that week, you start to get people that show up out of the woodwork, like that encourage you, that want you to be successful. And if they can help and it makes sense, you know, they offer it. And so he had a guy who basically owns a contract wildfire EMS company. And they basically, where they contract with the government to offer, you know, EMS services on wildfires. And so my son did that for a summer. And by the way, one of the cycles is a work cycle. So we're like, hey, you know, use a cycle to do something now, you know, to go make some money, focus on making money, still do some other things, but you know, your focus primary, your anchor activity is making money. And so he did that for working on wildfires. And he, as an EMT doing that, he made $600 a day, which, you know, I find still extraordinary. That seems like I think my take home pay, I know, you know, inflation, all that, but I think my take home pay from the Army was probably close to $600 a month.
Right.
You know, I mean, so $600 a day, and then you're out in the middle of nowhere. You have no expenses. All the expenses are taken care of, but you know, so you want to compound things. So parlay it into stuff. And you know, and I think when you stack up these different skills, they start to work in really interesting ways. I mean, one of the cycles is a hacker cycle. So you're talking about AI. I agree. You should, knowing to code, obviously that's not going to be the thing, but you should know how to build things in the virtual right. sphere too, because just like you, one of the cycles is you go to the Shelter Institute in Maine, and in 3 weeks you design and build a house. Like, that's a useful skill. So yeah. You just basically, you're one after another, you're just removing these things that are otherwise totally not understandable to you. Like, what exactly does it mean to, where do you even begin if you want to design a house? You know, how does the plumbing work? You know, you have no idea where to begin. So these things are like, if I want to build a website, how do I do that? You know, these things shouldn't be inaccessible to you. And the book basically strips those away one by one. So they're not.
Yeah. The other benefit is it's sort of a point we've raised, but with something like my kids are going to learn to code. We have a place nearby actually that will teach them, you know, basics of coding. I don't think any of them are going to be developers because I think that job is effectively going away. Certainly yeah. by the time they're going to be of age to be, you know, building anything. However, it will help them understand how these things work, which I think is just useful. It will help them understand problem solving, more critical thinking skills. Like it'll begin to, there are all of these positive externalities to just doing things that extend way beyond the thing that you're doing, right? And that's what many people miss. And even something like you talked about taking on menial jobs. I wish I had a couple summers painting fences out in the heat. It was miserable. It was hard. But of course, looking back, I'm like, those were some of the best.
You just
times.
Smiled. You just smiled when you said it. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
You
know? Like I learned how to do a thing. I learned the value of hard work. I spent time with my friends who were, you know, who were pitching in and helping. And, gosh, I mean, you learn how to show up on time. You learn how to take orders, do a particular thing. You learn that you should never eat the food at a fast food restaurant. A lot of beneficial things you can take away from even the dumbest sounding, you know, role. And I think most people just take that for granted. I wish I hadn't when I was that age. And I hope to impart that, you know, sentiment on my kids as they get older and they think about how am I going to, you know, afford to get a car and how am I going to afford to put gas in it? And you just do things, you know, it's not always going to be fun. But there's always a takeaway.
Well, the thing is, you say not fun, but the, just like you smiled when you're like, you know, remembering the suck of painting fences in the heat. The truth is that all of your memories are like that. All of the suck parts are basically the part, you know, the parts that you look back with fondness on. Yeah, like when you think about playing video games, you just think, oh, I play video games. There's literally, you know, there might have been a moment, I don't know, you know, playing video games where you like really remember, maybe, but probably not by comparison to anything that you do that really, actually, just if it sucks. I mean, Max and I talk about this all the time. Like the suck is where it's at. Like that's what you love later. That's the thing that you look back and go, I did something, you know? Yeah. And those things do add up. And when you talk about getting out there and doing it, I think you're right. And you brought up critical thinking. And the reason why people are such bad critical thinkers now is because they don't do anything in the real world. So they don't get feedback. They, you know, just like you're talking about with writing code. So if I'm writing a Python script, it doesn't work. Now, you know, it forces me to go and think deeply about what I did and try and understand the problem so I can fix my error. If I'm, you know, if I'm working on a house or a remodel job or something like that, same thing. Like I get immediate feedback. I tried to do something. It didn't work. What did I do wrong? How do I fix it? And so getting out there and doing stuff is the key to critical thinking. It's not thinking is not the key to critical thinking. It's doing that's key to critical thinking.
Yes, I agree. And I think the other trap we fall into is sort of an aside. I have a friend who I was talking about, like everything, the Charlie Kirk situation, everything going on. And they're a huge Candace Owens fan, love Tucker Carlson. Like those are sort of their go-to. And I'm like, I think some of the things they say, I probably agree with. I think there's a case to be made by a number of people about different things. And they were like, yeah, but like, why? Cause I was like, what if they're controlled opposition? Hypothetically, I don't know, but like, what if? And they're like, well, they don't seem to be, cause here's why. And I was like, listen, here's the problem. This is why people aren't thinking critically anymore, is they're finding one or two people who they basically knight as a saint. And they say, that person is going to do the work for me. And I trust them. I like a couple of things they say. So anything moving forward, I just trust. I said, for me, Candace, Tucker, Joe Rogan, Bill Maher, anyone, they're a node in my network of information. And they're all far enough out there that I assume probably they're wrong about something. But if I pull all this information together, I look at what independent journalists are saying, I read what normal people are just sort of how they're processing this information. Well, now I can begin to make a more informed decision. But as long as you worship the Republican Party, you worship the Democrat Party, you worship Candace, you worship Bill Maher, you worship anyone, you're always going to have incomplete information and your thinking is going to be pre-completed for you. And it's sort of what you were describing with, you know, we don't have these people for young, we don't have role models for young people to look up to. It's the same thing. If Taylor Swift is your role model, if Justin Bieber, I'm probably sounding dated mentioning some of these people, but you know,
dated. I'm dated. What are you talking about?
You know, yeah, you're, yeah, you probably have other references you'd make, but I'm sure I'm a couple years behind. But that's the enemy of critical thinking, is when someone else becomes the like your North Star. When one or two people become your North Star and you can just shut off your brain as soon as they tell you what you're supposed to think.
Yeah. And especially if it's somebody who you don't actually know. Okay. This is it's someone who shows up in your feed that you're fed and is very successful in the algorithm for some reason, maybe by design, who knows, but Yeah. If you, I think you can find an individual who could be act as that North Star for you, but it's someone, you know, it's not someone who's presented to you.
Yeah.
You know,
I assume like for you, I assume someone like Doug, who you've gotten to know, trust, love, respect. He's done a lot, great experience. He's been wrong, but you've seen him wrong before and he's been right most of the time. Someone like that makes a hell of a lot of sense for you to say, if Doug is saying something, I'm going to at least consider that very seriously and take it, you know, much more seriously than any number of talking heads on Fox or CNN.
Yeah. But again, the biggest reason for me is because I have a personal relationship with him. So I know his strengths and his limits.
Yep.
You know, I like, and you know, you can rely on people. You might find a North Star who's through the media, maybe you can rely on for a philosophical view. But as far as like facts or narrative, I would stay away in general, just relying on any party.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. Okay, so I want to round this out for us. So first of all, I want to get an update on Max, but can you first explain why are you in Uruguay and what led you to, because you're an American, correct?
Yeah, I'm also Uruguayan though. I just got my citizenship.
Congratulations. Yeah. So what led you there? And is that like a permanent place that you're going to be, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, well, we came down here. I had lived internationally before. I lived in Argentina for a couple of years in 2007. But during the COVID nonsense, you could see the trend of things. I didn't like the way things were trending, and they're still trending in the same direction, by the way. And you could see the end game with it all, at least with the economy, which is, you know, probably other things too. And I didn't like it. So by coming to Uruguay, I am essentially going back in time about 25 years in a lot of respects. And,
sounds like a nice place to be then.
Yeah. And well, especially, you know, just, you know, we've been here since, I guess we got here in, you know, 4.5 years ago. So, you know, especially for the last few years I had with my kids still, I wanted a good environment for them, a healthy environment. You know, I didn't know if people weren't going to allow me to go to the grocery store during the COVID nonsense. But, you know, here I don't need to go to a grocery store. I have a cattle ranch and we have everything we need, honestly. So, I don't know. I always wanted to own a ranch also. I had looked all over the U.S. for ranches to buy and I couldn't find anything that I liked that was like, that really felt like it was right for me. And this place that we have here is honestly, it's Eden in many ways. It really is pretty perfect. So we love it. I still have some stuff in the US. I've got cars, motorcycles, and an RV, but no real estate. And, you know, I still have some family there obviously, but yeah, I don't see myself moving back. Like we like it.
Terrific. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Okay. So Max is well on his way through this. He's the guinea pig. Could you just really quickly tell me how you've seen him change, what his feedback to you has been? You know, are there parts that he feels like, I don't know if I'd do that again, or maybe change things? Or in general, has he just adopted this as sort of a mindset, something he's going to accomplish and is enjoying?
Yeah, let's see where to start with it. I'd say the most important thing to me as a father is just simply the fact that sometime, I think it was actually on the sailing thing, believe it or not, but he went from being a boy to a man in all respects except for the final one, which is having kids. I think there's something missing until you have kids, but you know, in other respects, I mean every other respect, you'd consider him a man. And that change from here, where, you know, when we started this whole thing, he was anxious and pissed off, you know, not competent at anything, but also just lost, to being where he is confident. He's extremely capable, experienced, wiser. It's just totally like he, from boy to man in 2 years. I don't know how else to describe it. He's totally independent. I mean, in every way you can imagine, totally independent. And I'm quite proud of him. So to me, the book is a success because of that, because of that experience. But what Max's experience has been, and I'd say the difficulties he had, is that you know, the reason why Max is a co-author on the book is because he is completely a co-creator of the system, because we were co-creating it. I mean, he was doing all the work and we were just talking about it going, okay, well, like, let's problem solve. And, you know, and I could work through some things early on with him and then come up with like, what is the right structure to be using? So I think his biggest thing would be, I wish, you know, I had this structure when I started, because, you know, it feels like he wasted a lot of time or went down some, maybe some roads that he wouldn't have gone down, or maybe he would have taken. But overall, I don't think he has any regrets from it at all, because would he do some of those things again? I don't think so, but that's the whole point. That's the whole point of the cycles. It's like you do it and you're done. Like, I don't want to go through basic training in the Army again. Yeah. I'm glad I did, you know, but I definitely don't want to do it again. So I think that's, those experiences like that are great for you. So yeah, I'm sure there are some things there's things he likes more than other things that he did, but he's doing great. So he's like a little over 2 years into it now. So like 2 years in one cycle, I guess. And he's doing great. Where is it going to end up for him? You don't know. I don't know. I mean, his last cycle he did was this entrepreneurship cycle, and he did well with it. And I think it opened his eyes to the possibilities there. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I hope he's an entrepreneur of one form or another, ultimately, so he's not a wage slave, which is the alternative.
Well, it's got to be a good feeling to see that as a father. I think you can be proud and happy with the product you've produced here with this book. Last question for you. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend, I'll say, Bitcoiners and sound money advocates with it?
You should sell Bitcoin sometimes.
Okay.
Not all your Bitcoin. Yeah. But here's the thing. Yeah. Listen, so I've been through a lot of the cycles, you know, but I was never religious about Bitcoin. Okay. Like I saw early on what it could potentially be. But because, especially since 2016, I've been willing to sell as it started to go up. I didn't care if when it went down. I made so much money off of every up cycle, taking some profits, that then when it went down, the bulk of my holdings could remain, and I didn't care at all. It made no difference to me whatsoever. So, and I think that when people don't sell, when they had this big gain, and when it pushed up at the top of the cycle, and you didn't take any profits, it makes it really hard to hold it when it gets in the doldrums. And maybe the cycle is broken now and it's not doing what it has done repeatedly over the past. But that in the past, that volatility was a gigantic opportunity. I mean, think about it. It took me my third try buying Bitcoin for it to really work out for me. Thank God it had some cycles. Now, yes, I did buy it for a lot more, but I knew enough by the third time to buy a lot of it when it was cheap and, you know, rode that all the way up. And, but you should sell, you should take some profits. So don't sell all your Bitcoin, but sell some.
I think it depends. What you're saying makes sense. It depends on your thesis though. So my thesis of Bitcoin is that eventually it's going to be the money that the world migrates to, because it's the only thing that everyone can opt into permissionlessly. And while I agree that you can sell, you could potentially end up with more Bitcoin, I also know that there's a risk if people don't know what they're doing to end up with less Bitcoin. And so what I find prudent for my Bitcoin stack is just to, I earn in Bitcoin, I accumulate it, and I know that I could have more if I sold at certain times and repurchased at certain times. For me, it's not worth timing it. I'm not a trader. I'm not a experienced investor of any kind. So, but I hear your thought process.
Yeah, though. Let me explain one more thing. The reason my concern is the same as yours is that you end up getting out of it. And I'm saying that sometimes, especially if you've been through some of these crazy cycles, and you know when it's down, it's like there's a lot of hopelessness out there.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. I know. You know, it's performed well recently, obviously. In the last couple of years, it's done well.
It's easy for me to say, because my conviction is so high that there's not a bear market that shakes me, you know, shoots the Bitcoin out of my hand. You're right. There are a lot of people who are...
They come in, they buy at the top, and then they sell at the bottom and never look at it again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fair point. So if that's what people need to, as they build their conviction, I think maybe my guidance would be for those folks, continue to build your conviction, read the books, do the study, and put in the time. Because once you see it, once that switch is truly flipped, I think it's a lot harder for people to be shaken out of their stack.
That's the key. You don't want to be shaken out. And your own psychology is your worst enemy when it comes to investing. It really is. It messes with you. You're at war with your own psychology when it comes to investing.
Absolutely. Well, Matt, thank you so much for your time. Again, thank you for this book. I mean that. This is my son is going to be a different man at age 18, 22 than he's going to be a different man at age 10. Than if you had not written this book and I hadn't found it. So thank you so much. Any place you want to send people to find the book, to find out more about you, if you want to pass them along to Doug, anywhere.
Sure. Share that. I can give you a whole bunch of things. Number one, you can get the book on Amazon is the easiest way to get it. Number two, if you want to see what the results end up being like it with it, you can see Maxim's blog. It's at my son's maximsmith.com. And then the last one is that I do the podcast with Doug. Doug Casey's Take is what it's called. We're taking a hiatus for the last 6 weeks until we're starting after January 15th again. But it's good because Doug says, he's old, he's rich, and he just doesn't give a fuck. And so you get a different view from somebody who has, like him, who has nothing to gain and really it doesn't care. He is not trying to build his social media profile or anything like that. And so the conversations are good and honest.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it. We'll link to all of that in the show notes. But until next time, I hope we can stay in touch, but take care. Have a great day and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Matt. I know I had a blast talking to him. Again, one of the most important books I've ever read, at least for the future of my own children. But go support him. Go buy the book if this sounds at all interesting to you. If you're homeschooling your kids, if you have college-age kids, certainly this is a perfect book to start reading. And of course, you can go follow along with the podcast he does with Doug Casey. And if you enjoyed this show, do me a huge favor. Give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested. Do anything for us to feed the algorithm. We would really, really appreciate that. And of course, if you need help taking proper 100% self-custody of your Bitcoin, which you probably do, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We can also help you with protecting your online privacy, setting up a privacy phone, going Jason Bourne style. And we have a Plan B residency option as well that you'll want to hear about as the world goes crazy. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.